Okay, I think this might be our last such discussion, right?
Well,
Was there one tomorrow as well?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Yes, Nathaniel.
My question is about the meditation session. I hope I will say it clearly. On the one hand, we suppose while daydreaming to recollect to the thought, to the dream. And I can understand how it can make us mindful and aware, but I can't understand how it can help us inquire the conscience itself. And Martini several times said that when we have a disturbing thought, we need to be in the thought and to think about it. So my question is, while daydreaming, we are not supposed to be in the daydreaming and to inquire the conscience instead of coming back to the dreaming?
Okay. This is a little too more?
Point. My question is whether it's two types of meditation or two levels in one letter or something like that.
Yes. No, it's two different types. Because you see, there is two different things. There is, in a way, the concentration, which is the coming back to the object. Then there is the looking deeply, which then, as you leave the thought, notice what it is. So it's not like you kind of stay with the thought. It's more that you see, I was daydreaming. And then you come back, just as a mean to know what you were doing in terms of the thinking, which is one way to, but you're not obliged to do this all the time, but time to time it's interesting to see what am I thinking. Sometimes you don't really know actually what you were thinking, but that's never mind, and you come back. What I was saying is, when somebody was talking about when there is some theme, when there is some choices, then what you have, which I would suggest, is a meditative creative thinking. So that's a different thing there. Because you sit in meditation and you keep having this thing which come, so it's not just like daydreaming. It's more like, you know, a choice. For example, you have a choice to make. And then you keep thinking, should I do this? Should I do that? Should I do this? Should I do that? So if this is very strong and keep coming, then what I suggest is once a day for 30 minutes, let it be on meditation or at home, that's what you do. You sit in meditation and then you focus on the theme. And then the inquiry is you try to think about it differently. Because generally we're very repetitive. We go round and round in circle. So in this meditative creative thinking, you're trying to think about it differently, to have a new thought or think how somebody would see it, etc. So that's something I would just recommend when you really have something on your mind. Then, I was talking of the Vitaka Santana Sutta, which was on the form of thought. And again, then it was in specific situation where you have very intense thought, negative thought, because possibly something happened or whatever. And then the Buddha gave five different ways to deal with this very difficult thought. And so one of them was to change negative for positive, one was to see the peril of the thought, one was lack of attention, and one was looking inside, looking at the form of the thought, looking at the language of the thought, and the fifth one was to restrain the thought. So that's actually three different things.
Can you go through the three again? Can you repeat the three?
The three? So the first one is just what is a little called noting. It's just noticing, in a way, what we're thinking. And over time, we then can notice the texture of the thought nearly. It helps you to recognize more at the beginning why the mind inclined that way. Then the second one is more when there is a theme, and I would call it meditative creative thinking. And then the third one was, you know, using the five suggestion of the Buddha. Okay.
Conscience. You mean consciousness?
Right. Oh, that's for Steven.
No, it's not.
You see, personally, I am not interested in consciousness. I never use the word. And I have a friend who has written a book, an encyclopedia about consciousness. And I read the book and I was really reassured that nobody had an idea about it. They all contradicted each other. It's people who really think much better than me, and I thought, this is okay. If they can't know, then I really don't have to worry about it. So I would recommend that book. It's very good.
Yes.
But maybe we when I talk about vipassana, about inquiry, I'm talking of experiential inquiry, and then that is not an intellectual inquiry. Because then what you do, in terms of the vipassana aspect of the meditation, is more that you notice some element of the experience. So it's not focused on thought, necessarily. And even if you focus on thought, you would not focus on the content of the thought. You would focus more on the changing aspect of the thought. The same, you would focus on the feeling, not so much the content of the feeling, but the fact that they change. The same with the sensation. You notice the fact that the sensation change, the sound change. So then you look more at the characteristic of the experience. It is not an analysis of consciousness or trying to find consciousness, but that's another thing which I don't know anything about.
That's fine.
To be honest, I'm still confused. I don't know when I'm supposed to let the thought go, and I understand I'm not supposed to analyze or whatever, but when am I supposed to do this bodily investigating, this noticing of the no self or the transcendental?
Okay. So, see the concentration as resting the mind on the object. So you rest the attention on the breath. You rest the attention on the sensation. You rest the attention on the sound, whatever it is. That's a concentration. The inquiry is like if a beam of light is going inside the experience itself. So, you can do it separately. I mean, again, people have different ideas about that one, even in the Theravada tradition. Some people say it is one after the other. You start by focusing, and then consciously you go inside. Others say that it's simultaneous. So, personally, I think it's either or. You know, some technique make you do both at once, some technique make you do them a little separate. Stephen.
This is your department.
Is
it still unclear? I'm not quite sure what the question's about. It seems to refer to something Martin was saying.
No, it's talking about samatha and vipassana.
Is it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
And that's basically to
okay.
do both.
Well, basically, the two aspects of the practice have two different goals. shamatha, or in other words, concentration, is about bringing the mind to a more centered and a more still state. So you do that, obviously, if the mind is not feeling centered and still. This happens sometimes. It's wandering all over the place, or it's getting picked up by thoughts and fantasies and so on. So in that aspect, you need primarily to work with getting your mind more centered and still. And you can do that by simply attending to one object, let's say the breath. It doesn't have to be the breath, but the breath I find works quite well. So you just keep bringing the mind back to the breath. At a certain point, you'll find, hopefully, that the mind becomes more quiet. And not only more quiet, but somehow more deeply grounded in the body. And it's from that place, that groundedness, that stillness, that you can use your shamatha, your concentration, as a kind of a platform from which you can then look into and analyze and inquire and question what it is that's going on. And there are different ways of doing this. In the early tradition, you, as Martin said, you begin to notice that this experience has certain characteristics which we tend to overlook. It's changing. It's somehow undependable, unreliable, dukkha. And at another level, it is not me. It's not mine. It is simply an impersonal, physical, emotional, mental process that's coming and passing away. So you, in order to apply this kind of looking, vipassana, seeing, we require a greater stability and groundedness in our body, in our mind, than we might normally have. So it's a question of playing the two off, one against the other. If, for example, as often happens, your inquiry begins to take you into things that seem terribly interesting and it gets a bit intellectual again, stop, back to the breath, ground the attention. And when you feel grounded, start looking carefully at what's going on. Start, as Martin says, sensing and feeling the texture, the feel, the fluidity, the movement, the unfolding, the sheer sort of flux of life. And simply noting that, just being aware of that, registering these characteristics. It's not that we don't know that, we do, intellectually. It's to try to turn that idea into part of your felt experience. So you begin to be more sensitized, not only in meditation, but in daily life, to the changing nature, the dukkha nature, the impersonal nature of experience. That begins to somehow infuse your consciousness as a whole. It begins, as I was saying this morning, to reorient your fundamental perspective on yourself and on the world. And in that sense, it becomes very much dukkha parinya, the fully knowing of dukkha, that then leads through that perspective over time, and perhaps at moments of great clarity, to a kind of falling away of habitual mental behaviors. Grasping, clinging, wanting things to be like this, wanting things to be like that. You become, as it were, fascinated, inspired, amazed, astonished by the sheer unfolding of life itself. And that becomes a foundation not only for your meditative experience, but also for how you then begin to relate to the world itself. Is that clear? Okay. Good. Next. Where do we go next?
You're speaking a lot about, of course, about self-centeredness and impersonal aspect of experience, or personal.
Impersonal or personal?
The experience of something, that you experience something impersonal. So can you elaborate more about the question of anatta, about no self?
So the question has to do, we've been talking, I use the word impersonal, anatta, not self. Could I elaborate a bit more on that? In some ways, it's in contrast to how we normally think of things. We experience our body and we think of it very much, quite naturally really, as mine. And of course, in some sense, that's true. My body is certainly not your body. It's not anybody else's. But we invest that sense of me and mine with a kind of solidity, a realness, that when we start to look into experience, we don't actually find. And when we, for example, are attending to the breath, or to the feelings in the body, or the sensations in the body, or to our even our simple moments of awareness and consciousness itself, each time we look more closely at any of these processes, we don't find anything in there that you can point to and say, ah, that's me, that's Stephen. I don't find Stephen in my legs, in my pain in my knees, in my thoughts, in my emotions, in my awareness. That very real nugget, that cell of me around which so much of my life is constantly turning. Let's face it, I am the hero of my drama. Much of my wandering thoughts are basically about me. What Martin sometimes called me-ing or selfing. But when, although that seems to be so real, when you begin to attend more closely to these processes, that very real feeling slips away. It's somehow unfindable. It's like you try to pick it up, but the water, it's like water, it just slips through your fingers. The Dalai Lama has an expression, he says, Dzogchen Tsuksa Mindu, which means, as you know, it means there is no finger putting place, literally. There's nothing you can put your finger on. So we have this curious experience of being me, of being a self, of being something constant and permanent and fixed and that's always there. But as soon as we start looking for it, there's nothing we can find. It's the and this is what emptiness means, really. Emptiness means, in the Dalai Lama's tradition and the one I was trained, it means the ultimate unfindability of anything. There's a kind of infinity within experience. It seems real, but you can't, when you look for it, actually pinpoint it. There's a text attributed to Nagarjuna called the Ratnavali, and he says it's like someone's walking in a desert, and they see, in the distance, they see an oasis. They see palm trees, camels, little shops selling Coca-Cola, and they think, oh, drink. And they go towards it, but the closer they get, the more it vanishes, because it's a mirage. And in a way, our sense of I is, in a sense, like a mirage. As long as it's constituted at a certain distance, under certain conditions of so-called normal experience, it seems real. When you try to sort of reach it and take it, it slips away. It somehow eludes your grasp. So experience, therefore, is realized not to be as sort of fixed and as self-centered as it often seems to be. And the practice of vipassana, the practice of this sort of inquiry, is to probe into the flux of sensations, of feelings, of emotions, of thoughts, of consciousness, and each time to just notice there's no me there. Now, this doesn't mean, though, that you don't exist. It means that you don't exist in the way we often think and feel we do, as some kind of solid, constant point of reference. And that, I think, is what is meant. That's how I would understand anatta. So it's again, it's like anicca is to notice that our experience is not sort of fixed and permanent and always like this, but it's always in flow. Anatta is to see that there's actually nothing in it that you can pin down as me or mine. And that has experientially a kind of, it sort of unblocks our sense of experience. Mara is convinced that there is a very solid nugget or cell of ego, and the Buddha, when he looks in, he realizes actually, although it appears to be the case, it feels very much to be the case, when you really analyze it, it's not there. And yet when you return, as it were, to your daily life and getting on with your friends and neighbors, of course, it's you and them and me and my story, and that's fine. There's no problem with that. The problem is when we solidify or reify that that functional sense of identity into something absolute and something really real. Yes, and then we'll come back here.
I have a question, but I have my own answer to it.
Oh, good. So then next one.
But I'm not satisfied.
Ah.
Regarding the Four Noble Truths,
mm-hmm.
This morning, the Buddha describes in great detail what he defines impact. It includes aging, sickness, and death. And in Nibbana, supposedly there is the end of the cessation of this.
The cessation of aging, sickness, and death, you mean?
Right.
Mm.
And yet the Buddha was subject to...
Well, look in the first sermon and look at the Third Noble Truth and see what it says. It doesn't say, when it says this is the cessation of dukkha, it doesn't say the cessation of dukkha, the cessation of suffering is the cessation of birth, sickness, aging and death. It doesn't say that. You know what it says?
The cessation of dukkha.
No, it doesn't. It says it's the cessation of craving. So that's not only my answer, it's also the Buddha's answer. I think that's an extremely important point. I don't want to get into that now, but I don't want to get into that now. But I think about that. Because you see there's there is a misfit. The first truth, dukkha, he describes it. He gives a whole list of things that are dukkha. Second truth, craving, gives a very good definition of craving. Third truth, cessation of dukkha, he doesn't describe it at all. He says it's the cessation of that craving. Something's odd is going on here. Fourth truth, the path, he describes it. Third truth, something else is happening. He doesn't describe the dukkha nirodha, the ending of suffering, as taking no more rebirth, no more birth, sickness, aging and death, which would be a clear-cut definition. He says something quite different. He says it's a cessation of craving. Next question.
I had a problem with this, the last guided metta meditation.
Oh, good.
At the end, wishing to all different beings, and then somehow at the end I got to criminals, and I got stuck there, and then I started thinking about it, and I really couldn't, and I don't even think I wanted to wish happiness and no suffering to criminals. And not from the point that they did bad and then they deserve to suffer and they should be punished, but from the point that at any point in time, I think there are some people that the best thing that could happen to them is that they have at least some mental anguish that would lead them to changing and being a better person. So, first of all, is it possible to do a meta meditation like that, that I wish you people a little bit of suffering. and this comes, I think there's something Judeo-Christian about this idea of repentance, penitence. Is there anything about this in Buddhism?
Okay, so the first one, you see, I recommended no, in the difficult to either omit the like, neutral and dislike category, that's a good shortcut meditation, which generally doesn't raise any difficulties. then I suggested that for the dislike category, to not bring people of an intense nature. So for some people it will be politician, not to bring them at all, and for other it could be criminals, you know. So in terms of one doing the practice, that's generally what I would recommend, not to choose something which then leads to elaboration. Because the meditation, even the loving kindness meditation, is about concentration and experiential inquiry. So in a way, if you go on at a tangent thinking about criminals, this does not really serve the purpose. So that's why generally I recommend not to go with people which really set you going. So that's on the side. Then as to the criminal category, then you see, personally, again, one has to be very careful that this loving kindness is not a prayer. It's not a prayer. I feel sometimes people take it too literally. It's actually more the cultivation of an intention. And for me, the cultivation of an intention is that we, not the object, we open our heart. This really is a practice for us to be aware of others, for us to open our heart. With that, it's not a prayer at a distance which will make a difference to the object. So that's why I think again, this is for us to do it, to open our heart. Then back to the problem of the criminal, which is something else, in terms of repentance. In Buddhism, they're very big on repentance, especially
in East Asia.
Mahayana Buddhism, Chinese Buddhism, ooh, they have huge, different, kind of very different method of repentance. Chame is very big. You do lots of bowing. I mean, sometimes they do lots of bowing, you know, they have a big thing, they have a whole ceremony of repentance. And even they have an interesting method of repentance, actually, which became just as only in Korea I have found that method, which is again personal. It's not about others, it's about yourself. When if you make a mistake, or even if it looked like you make a mistake, even if you did not make one, you go and you say, I made a mistake. You bow 3 times and then it's finished, never to be ever mentioned again. It's very interesting. So that just this idea of knowing that one had made a mistake, knowing that one has caused suffering, etc. It's very much about that, this repentance. But Stephen is the one who worked with criminal, because for 10 years he was a Buddhist chaplain, so I think he would be better at talking about.
Yeah, I just briefly. Our perception of people in prison is basically a very convenient way for us to project all the things that are bad onto them. Prisons function as kind of sinkholes for all our negative projections, all the nasty, bad, evil people in there, and they should be punished. And I remember when I first went into a jail, I was frightened. I thought, you know, I was going to be, someone would grab me and take me up onto the roof and put a gun to my head. But the thing I learned very, very quickly was that the people in the jail were just like us. Just like us. They'd just taken a couple of wrong turns. Or very often they'd been brought up in the most ghastly social conditions. And, you know, it was almost inevitable that they would end up doing things that would end up in jail. So I think we have to be careful of how much we perceive criminals somehow as a way of projecting our own shadow, both personally and our social shadow, onto those evil people. And working with prisoners was very much, for me, a very humbling experience, because I recognized that a few wrong turns in my own life, a few conditions that perhaps had been might have been very difficult for my life, and I could have easily just been there as well as them. I met very, very, very few people in jail who really struck me as somehow kind of...
Well, there was one or two.
There was one or two people in jail who I was really glad were there. But the vast majority not.
Yeah.
Yes. Could you try and speak a little? I can hardly hear you.
Martin, you keep on talking about giving half an hour to thinking. And I'm thinking, blessed be the day that I can say, okay, the thought I'll put into half an hour. But it doesn't go into half an hour. It comes up, if there's a thought, and you spoke to that, but if there's a thought, there's, it comes up every second. You know, it's something, not a random thought, but a real thought. It comes up, especially with something that is crucial for life or for some type of decision. It comes up, and my question then is, if I can do the half an hour, it doesn't work. Maybe if I do 6 hours a day, then it could work. Instead of 12 hours, I'll do six. That might be more realistic. But half an hour a day, it's not even worth trying.
Ah, but you see, this is a point. This is a point. This is a point. You say it's not worth trying, so you've not tried it.
It's not worth trying. I've tried it. We've been together for 7 days. I've tried it. The question is still, if we're using the word criminal, I was thinking, what are the crimes I've done in the last 7 days? I've talked too much. And I'm thinking, how does one, if this crime does come up, thought comes up, and I steal those minutes from meditation to think through the decision. Then how does one make it softer there? I know you told us the five things of the Buddha. It would help me.
But it comes back. It comes back to the level. It comes back to the level that if there is something which happened. If you are into this intense obsessional rumination because something happened, and then because of that something happening, you have to make a decision, it's nearly unavoidable that it's going to go round and round and round. Then the meditation can help only in term that it will have a little less intensity, it will last a little less long. But I think it's also according to people, to what they do. If they have a tendency to think a lot anyway, that's what they'll do. Then some people might cry a lot, some other people might do something else. I think it's also according to condition, also according to one's circumstances. And personally, at that level, one has to accept it, that you're not... Of course you have this, the problem is because one wants, in a way, not to have them. But that they are there at that moment. So if the 30 minute doesn't work, and we can't kind of keep it just to that, and then leave it. Because to me, this is what I believe, and this is what I have seen. That the more we think about something, the more we get stuck. So to me, that's why I really do that. I think a little about something, and then I drop it. Because I know the benefit of just letting it be. Because then it does not get so intense. And then I can come back to it freshly. But personally, I've over time seen that. I go round and round and round, I can't sleep at night. And it does not help whatsoever. So I do this a few times and I think, maybe let's try something else. And then, so I don't think about it. I really give it the space, but not in repression. I don't repress it. But because I believe the space is better than continuing to think about it. Because I think our difficulty is we think we have this mechanism within ourselves as human being. We are solving machine. This is a survival mechanism, evolution. We are solving machine.
Problem solving machine,
meaning making machine. This is all the one. This must have a meaning. A lot of the time it has no meaning whatsoever. So we have these two things going on. And I think if we accept that not everything need to have a meaning, if we accept that problem solving cannot just be done with the intellect, I think it's kind of accepting the limitation of the intellect and having more faith, I would say, into the wisdom of the organism. And personally, that's what I do nowadays, generally. I just have this wisdom that if I think a bit about something which is on my mind, then I stop, then it works within the organism. Then I can look at it again, try to see if there is any, what I would call, creative movement. If there is creative movement, I continue with it. If I see it's just repeating, then, and if I see that the repeating doesn't go into the positive, but the repeating go into the negative, then I stop. What's the point of, you know, repeating negatively something? So it's kind of like working with that. But the final point is that, you see, when I talked, and that's what the question I felt was from Nathaniel and the other person, was that when I tell you to look at your thought, I actually more talking about daily life. Because I feel that normally if you're on a retreat, most of the time, unless something has happened recently, there is not much going on. You got daydreaming, ruminating, but you know, you can sit and, you know, generally try to come back from it. But to me, what is more interesting is in daily life, because that's in daily life that you will see what goes on. So what I feel that we're doing in meditation is developing the power of creative awareness. But that, unfortunately, I have to tell you that. I'm very sorry about that one. That it takes time for the power of creative awareness to really become strong. I must say so. This I cannot not say so. The releasing happened relatively fast. You can release relatively fast. But the power of creative awareness takes time. Because you have to exercise it. You have to do it in daily life. You really have to do it in daily life. And then the more you do it, the more it builds up. And then finally one day it works. And then you stop going round and round in circle. But it has to build up. It's not going to, and that's why it's frustrating, I was saying. Because you see yourself doing it and you can't do much about it. And that's why we continue to meditate, and that's why we continue to apply it in daily life. It takes time. That's why we have to have a little patience with those thoughts, I would say.
My second question, and it doesn't have to be answered, but if the two of you, if it's right for you, if you think it's relevant for us, before you meet us, can you tell us why you left the convent?
The convent?
The monastery.
A monastery. You had a great time in the convent. maybe tomorrow, yeah. We'll see. Thank you. Yeah.
I'd like to revert back to aging, sickness, and death.
Uh-huh.
There is an underlying assumption that somehow with sunyata and anatta, there is a part that survives, that survives death.
In the sense of being reborn. The body of the Buddha.
Let me just try to get to the edge.
Well, I would take it much in the way that the physicists would describe it. Nothing ever is lost. The universe is entropic; it's running down. But the amount of matter or energy or whatever, and I'm sure someone can say it better than me, will always remain the same. But I don't believe in any sort of little personalized bit that is some weird way me, whether it's some mental continuum or some energetic pattern, or what the Tibetans would call, when they really get down to the fine tuning of this, the combination of very subtle prana and or energy and very subtle mind that is the mere I. That's technically what gets reborn. But that to me is just metaphysics. I don't know what on earth they're talking about. It's a nice idea, but to me it whiffs very much of some metaphysical entity that has to somehow be defined in order to fulfill the doctrine that we are reborn and our karma will follow us from life to life. Now, maybe it's like that. Who knows? But I can't think of any way whereby one could ever have any validation of such a theory. So no, I don't see any grounds for really making those sorts of claims. And all I think that continues after our death are the consequences of our acts. In other words, you know, if I drop dead now, that doesn't mean that the consequences of my life will somehow stop. They won't. People will still be foolish enough to read my books. People will still listen to these tapes. Things I've said and done in all sorts of circumstances will perhaps continue to reverberate for some time. And so I don't believe in some sort of entity that survives death, but I do believe very strongly that our actions, that we are responsible in every act we take for deeds and effects that will outlive us, both personally and also socially, communally, collectively. And that means we have a responsibility for the world that we will leave behind. That to me is more important than the fact that I'll be around in some disembodied way to experience that. And I think that's a good point to end.
There is a good yes. one then.
And just to confirm what you just said, I had about mindfulness, I had my problems. And this afternoon while cutting the cucumber, suddenly Archimedes and Newton came forward. And both of them actually found their physics law rules within their mindful of what they were doing. One was doing his bath, enjoying it very much. And the other one was sitting under an apple tree.
Oh, Newton, yes.
Yes, and the apple tree, and he found it very interesting. And so, I'm accepting it now.
Thank you.
Thank you. So please have a good supper, and then we'll meet again at 7.